The story of the descent of Kabbalism from its older foundations is in itself a rather interesting and intriguing account. Of course, during the medieval period, from say the 8th to the 13th centuries of the Christian era, Kabbalism was introduced into Europe, probably from among the Arabs, who developed quite an elaborate system derived, for the most part, from the older Jewish mystics. After the Renaissance, the Kabbalists became an intellectual group. They had some distinction and were counted as scholars of importance. Their rising sphere of religious influence, to the degree that this began to affect the interpretation of the Torah or the law, resulted in some mild persecution and considerable ridicule. Both the persecution and the ridicule came principally from Orthodox Jewish people who felt that a heresy was arising in their midst, inasmuch as many elements of lore and metaphysics came into the Kabbalistic pattern and might be regarded as producing the same effect then as some pseudo-mystical work might produce in modern Christendom. By the 15th or 16th centuries, Kabbalism had really reached its maximum sphere of influence. By this time, it had attracted to itself quite a number of learned Christians. And these scholars became not only faithful interpreters of the Jewish writings, but began to interpret them in terms of Christian religious philosophy. There is no doubt that the principal church theologians of the Renaissance period were influenced by Kabbalism, and it was even taught in some of the Christian theological seminaries. Men of the caliber of Noah von Rosenroth devoted their lives to the study, not of the Kabbalah in its transcendental or magical sense, but in its philosophical meaning. Sensing that somewhere in this compound was valuable and practical knowledge. With the rise of the modern scientific method in the 17th century, Kabbalism began to decline. But before it passed into comparative obscurity, it mingled its streams with alchemy, and to a measure, the 17th century Rosicrucian mystery. The Kabbalists also gained a new kind of fame, becoming Faustian types of scholars who were supposed to have pacts with demons and to be accompanied by familiar spirits. Many legends and much lore accumulated, and somewhere along the line, the infamous 6th and 7th books of Moses were invented. This invention was comparatively recent. In Germany, Kabbalistic books were publicly burned, not because of anti-Semitism, but because they dealt with subjects of demonology and witchcraft. After this situation, Kabbalism in the non-Jewish world almost completely faded from view. The remaining Kabbalists were mostly in the ghettos of European cities, especially in Germany and Poland. And most of these Kabbalists were rabbis, but they were not particularly well thought of by their own communities. They were not the good Orthodox kind of rabbi, but strange, wild-eyed scholars dealing in magic and abominable arts. They were feared, and a certain amount of superstition that has always followed in the train of Jewry gave them a vestige of importance. Many persons regarded themselves as bewitched. Many kinds of magic were practiced in a time when these practices were held to be valid, and when some Jewish magician found himself hopelessly involved in either a genuinely magical or a psychologically metaphysical situation from which he could not extricate himself, he would usually quietly seek out one of these ancient scholars for help and perhaps for delivery from possession by an evil spirit. This situation continued mildly and faintly up to the 19th century. By this time, the entire subject was more or less considered as extinct. Not much was heard about it. We know there were still scattered scholars, a few enthusiasts struggling to preserve what they held to be an ancient, authoritative revelation. But with the rise of modern science, the younger men, both among the Jews and the Gentiles, found little interest in these abstract theories about creation. They were inclined to follow in the ways of Darwin and Huxley and Spencer and explore the new materialistic universe that was unfolding around man. By the last quarter of the 19th century, however, certain reasonable doubts had arisen as to the completeness and adequacy of the scientific position. Science was answering many questions, but it was causing more questions than it could possibly answer. And each new scientific discovery opened a world of mysteries for which no reasonable solution could be immediately found. There was also a gradual sense of fear arising. Men began to wonder if this universe that had been torn away from its divine footings was actually progressing in a positive direction, or whether it was merely falling into a new kind of superstition, the superstition of godlessness. This led to a considerable revival of interest in Kabbalism, mostly among Gentiles. And we find that the various metaphysical movements that developed in the United States and Europe in the last quarter of the 19th century often included this subject among matters for further investigation. The 20th century found only a few articulate Kabbalists. These wrote on the subject, collated the available literature, and their findings were tucked away in library shelves and in old bookstores when only a few found interest in them. About 1925 to 30, however, there was a new interest in this subject. This interest seemingly began to manifest itself simultaneously in two areas. One considerable area in Germany, where both Jewish and non-Jewish scholars began to take the Kabbalah very seriously. The second area was in Jerusalem itself. And from what we are able to learn, in Israel today, the Kabbalah is no longer regarded as merely a medieval superstition. It has become a legitimate area for research and thought. Perhaps one of the helpful things that happened was that man's increasing scientific knowledge and his ability to cope with world literature on a more intimate basis resulted in a new attitude toward Kabbalistic interpretation. It became possible that in the Kabbalah would be found scientific material. The structure of the doctrine was highly mathematical. It seemed almost archetypal. It appeared to have been impressed upon the Jewish folk mind as a pattern or an ordered revelation. To many scholars, it was perhaps the very flowering of Jewish religion. It certainly represented the motion of a religion away from a simple state of faith into an elaborate area of research, a tremendous effort to rationalize, understand, and interpret the religious doctrines of the Jewish people. Again, this might have been helped by an increasing tendency of both Jewish and Christian scholars to question the literal translation or the literal meanings of Bible statements. It became increasingly difficult, for example, to accept the opening chapters of Genesis as a literal account of creation. Also, scholarship seeking for a justification for the extraordinary respect in which the Old Testament was held began to experience difficulty in sustaining this respect on the level of the prevailing teachings and opinions. Just as Christian mystics found it necessary to their own inner consolation to seek for a mystical meaning to their scriptures and to enlarge the area of their spiritual consciousness of religious truths, so the same happened among the Jewish scholars. And to a measure, this was important to Christendom also, inasmuch as the Old Testament is an essential part of the Christian Bible. As a result of the Kabbalah, it was possible to reconcile a great deal of the difference between religion and science. In the Kabbalah, religion revealed certain powerful scientific aspects. It seemed quite conceivable that the Kabbalah could sustain and support not only our more recent opinions about the nature of the universe, time, space, existence, generation, life, and death, but might even reach into the mystery of this electronic age, describing and unfolding mysteries long concealed in difficult and archaic Hebrew words, which when adequately and properly translated and interpreted in the proper context and sense, suddenly become meaningful, become intriguing and inviting of further thought. So we now find that most scientific and educational and cultural groups do not regard the Kabbalah today as an old superstition. I can well remember when even progressive thinkers would hardly consider touching this subject because of its involvement in magic and sorcery. It belonged in the very outer edge of the lunacy fringe. But now, this fringe has taken on an orthodoxy, a reasonableness, and an intelligence. And we are beginning to realize that the so-called foibles of one generation become the solid facts of the next. Thus today, to bring the subject to focal point, the study of the Kabbalah is for the most part regarded as respectable. There will still be a number of very orthodox Jewish people who will view it with fear, who will consider it part of a divine mystery which should be left alone. But then there are also a number of orthodox Christians who feel that any effort to question or interpret or penetrate the outer surface of the Christian scriptures should be regarded as little less than heresy. So we have the Jots and Tittles followers on both sides of this situation. But the more liberal scholar, the leader in his field, the influential intellectual, is now Kabbalah conscious. And I think we will observe in the very near future an unfoldment of a trend now beginning to be evident, of a large and generous literature appearing upon this subject, perhaps a literature that will excel in quantity, at least, the material bearing upon the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, why is the Kabbalah suddenly of interest? It is of interest because modern science is still faced with the same problems that are said to have contributed to the suicide of Aristotle. Namely, that all of the research that is being accomplished deals with secondary processes in nature, essential processes. The principles at the roots of things are as obscure now as they were 25 centuries ago. Science has many explanations for many things, but it has never touched the problems that are dealt with essentially by the Kabbalah. This does not mean that the Kabbalistic answers must be correct, but they invite a thoughtfulness because no better thought is available. If this be the case, it is quite certain that modern physicists will become more interested in the subject. I have mentioned before that it was reported that Einstein was much concerned with the early philosophy of the Kabbalah. It was a kind of religious science, a science dealing with divine things. And it handled certain problems which perhaps we can summarize in a few statements. First of all, the Kabbalah, together with most religious beliefs, moved upon the assumption of an eternal God, a being in all things sufficient, an essence, principle, or power enduring and sustaining itself by itself throughout all time and space. This power was innately and intrinsically all good and all knowing. It was absolute and in its authority, and before the face of this one there was no other. Thus, existence seems to emerge from a sovereign intellect, an intellect by its own essential condition and quality, unlimited, unrestricted, and inevitable. So the Kabbalah asks a very simple, direct question that many others have asked, a question with which Plato and Aristotle both struggled, a question which has disturbed St. Thomas Aquinas just as much as it perturbed Socrates. The question is this: how can that which is of itself perfect, in no way deficient in anything, all-knowing and all-powerful, produce from itself a secondary state less than itself? In other words, how does it happen that from an eternal good, that which is not so good can come? How is it, for instance, that any part of creation can be ignorant if it exists within a nature eternally all-wise? If our own constitution is composed of a substance, itself in turn composed of consciousness and intellect, how does it happen that we are able to enjoy so much unconsciousness and so little intellect? Also, by what reason, purpose, motivation, or authority would that which is already all in itself, beyond which there can be no more, why should this enter into a state of creation at all, for any reason, at any time? What can it create that it is not already possessed of in its own nature? In what way can creation be more than a diminishing of the power of that which is without limit and without adversary, without obstacle, without obstruction? The second question probably the Kabbalists have been most concerned with is the creation of man, the evolution of species and types of life. The Kabbalists were for the most part pagan to the degree that they recognized a universe of living things. The law of evolution perhaps was not so defined by them, but it was certainly inherent in their doctrine and tradition. Therefore, we have the all good, the eternal Father, producing from himself a being in his own image, empowered with his own attributes, and being actually an extension of himself. The first thing that this image does is to become tempted and fall. Now, what is the weakness in this image? Why is this image unable to maintain its own divinity? And how does it happen that an all-knowing and all-powerful deity permits a creature which it has fashioned in its own likeness to be exposed to a fall, or to fall, when in all substance and essence its condition must eternally be fully known by its own creator? The next question, that seems to be rather reasonable and logical, then has to do with the problem of the redemption of this creature, the power by means of which this creature is brought back again to the state of its own divine nature. This redemption is a slow and arduous process in which the creature, struggling desperately through the mystery of the creation, must ultimately be reunited with the substance of the Creator. This was an elaborate formula in itself. There were other points, but these are perhaps the dominant ones, and it is still questionable whether science has any answer for these. It is doubtful whether the average Orthodox theologian has any answer. It is very questionable if the various religions of the world today can come together and agree upon even a mutually acceptable hypothesis. This, then, seems to justify the Kabbalists in their desperate effort to relieve their own minds and hearts of these reasonable doubts concerning the mystery of the divine nature. The problem, then, of the eternity of deity can only be approached in one or two ways. First, is deity actually ultimate, final, eternal, inevitable, and all-powerful? It would seem that one or more of these qualities must be compromised in order that creation can take place. There must be some deficiency in deity, or this deficiency could not result in a deficiency in the creation. If there was an imperfection in deity, then the creature fashioned in its image might also be imperfect. If there is an imperfection in deity, the process of creation itself might be imperfect, or subject to certain accidents or circumstances which were beyond the control and government of the divine power. Obviously, this solution invites only a doubt about deity and begins to reduce or limit the power of deity. Some groups, even among the Kabbalists themselves, tried to wave this question aside with the simple concept that the nature of deity is unknowable. Therefore, the circumstances incident to the beginning of existence are simply incomprehensible by man, who must accept that which he experiences and observes, but cannot attempt to analyze the ultimate causes for these experiences. The second solution to the problem perhaps was most essentially Kabbalistic. It is actually innate in the Old Testament, because the deity of the Old Testament is essentially anthropomorphic. That is, it is a deity existing in a condition of great power, but also existing in the presence of an adversary, also greatly empowered. That the universe arises from a dual principle rather than from a single principle. This dual principle is a polarity. This polarity suggests, therefore, that there is both energy and resistance everywhere in space itself. That energy is forever moving, which is the power of God. And resistance is forever impeding, which is the power of the adversary. Now, it would seem that, especially in the old Jewish beliefs, there is abundant ground to assume that the deity worshipped by the Israelites was not entirely a perfect God. Yet this deity was gradually advanced, not only in Jewish mysticism, but later in Christianity, to a condition of total paternity, total fatherhood over the entire creation. So as men began to build more and more upon the power of the one God, they became more and more involved in the desperate effort to explain how one God, eternally good, could either cause or permit evil. The more they stressed the one God, the more they forced evil upon that God as being the only possible solution to the fact that the all-powerful was not all-powerful in all things. The Kabbalah goes into this in a little different way and gives us a new kind of comprehension. A comprehension which was later picked up by medieval mysticism and finds considerable expression in the Rosicrucian theories of Robert Fludd and Michael Meyer. Deity as a being might be regarded as the supreme or superior apex of beings. Deity was not regarded in this concept as being merely an ultimate abstract absolute. Deity was considered to be a great being, or as Plato called it, an animal existing in space. This supreme being, so called, was certainly the leader of the creations which came from it. But this being, it also existed in something. And this in somethingness apparently had to precede being itself. In other words, if a being exists, it exists in time and space. If it has a beingness, it has an abode. It has a certain assignment of area in space. We may assume, for example, that being is infinite, that space is infinite, and therefore that the two become one fact. But the Kabbalah points out the possibility that the infinite being and the infinite space do not have to be identical, but that actually infinite being is an infinitely evolving power growing in infinite space. This is not unscientific, but it gives to the problem this situation that as man, born in this world, abides in a certain place, living in a community, city, and united with others to form the inhabitants of a region. So as we look forth upon the heavens, with the infinitude of stars, with the vast pulsing mass of the Milky Way, with the galaxies extending beyond even the most powerful modern telescope, we may well be looking upon a populated firmament, an area which is peopled with gods, each of which, in its own turn, is the inhabitant of space. Within the nature of this god arises its own creation, even as within the nature of man is sustained a vast order of life. To us, the small lives within the corporeal constitution seem little better than the minutest of microbes. But in the various dimensions of space, we do not know. Perhaps the very cells and atoms and electrons of our own bodies have their Platos and their Socrates. We don't know. It is beyond us. We cannot even estimate. That which we cannot estimate because it is smaller, we look down upon. That which we cannot estimate because it is greater, we look up to. But we are not sure of the meaning of either look or the direction in which we turn. We are not sure that bigness is the secret or mystery of authority, or that smallness is the true indication of humility. These factors may be completely arbitrary, created by our own minds, and having no meaning or existence outside of the intellectual processes of the Homo sapiens. This, then, caused the Kabbalist to contemplate a very interesting thought. If deity and all the great heavenly beings whose wings filled with eyes are the very stars of space, this magnificent creation, this Merkaba of righteousness, this chariot of mystery, this creation all exists within something. Now we can proceed by Aristotle's process of regressive evasion to come to the simple conclusion that the only answer is that our God lives in a greater God, this in a greater God, and so on until our inquiry is exhausted, but nothing is answered. The Kabbalists did not feel, however, that this was exactly true. From my researches in the subject, I believe that they felt that there was another kind of existence apart from being. Now, this might get us into trouble with Parmenides and a good many other classical thinkers. And so all we can do is blame the early rabbis working by their oil lamps. Is there something that has an existence apart from being? The possible use of two terms might explain this or give us working language. This may have little to do with the dictionary, but it may be useful for us in the next three or four evenings. And that is to define or divide or differentiate being and existence. Now, we can do this in a rather simple manner. Being certainly suggests a creature, a being of some kind. Being suggests an objectivity of life, a state of coordinated or integrated activity. Being suggests the opposite of not being. But not being itself does not necessarily suggest vacuum. Not being suggests a state in which a not beingness may have its own natural condition. This we will term existence. For existence does not necessarily suggest God, but being can, especially if it is capitalized. So the Kabbalah seems to tell us that in the beginningness of all beginnings, being rested in existence. This existence came into manifestation as being. But this existence is not merely another kind of God that must keep on retiring into some higher order of hierarchy until it goes beyond reason or into the intelligence. This existence is simply the infinite potential of life, energy, time, and space. Now, these in themselves do not have to be persons. They can be like the surface of a vast ocean. They can be rich in substances and even in essences. But they may have in themselves no self-awareness, as we know self-awareness. This existence may slumber forever. And there is something very reminiscent of it in the more rarefied strata of higher Buddhism, where it seems to come very close to the Mahaparinirvanic state. This state, as Buddha himself tells us, is a continuance with non-existence, as we know non-existence, non-beingness. It might almost be called a kind of existence without being, going on and on and on. Now, this in itself doesn't solve too much, but perhaps it gives us a kind of wedge. And this brings to our attention some of the earliest speculations of the Kabbalists, as set forth in the writings of Rabbi Akiba, and later the writings in the medieval period of Isaac the Blind. This essence-ness, like the ocean, cannot be regarded as a god. Even the Greeks had to create an ocean deity and give him domain over the seas. The deity ocean was not identical with the physical substance of ocean. But what was it that dwelt forever? Not as a being, but in existence, indivisible from it, innate in it, continuing through it. Something that had its authority from the infinite beyond the infinite. Something that was old before gods were fashioned. Something that goes on and on like the strange antiquity of race, so that all men are descended from an old line that goes back to a dawn which cannot be measured. And in the Kabbalah, that which exists in the substance of existence, apart from being, was called Torah. Now in Torah we have usually the concept of the law. We are of the opinion that the term Torah should be applied to the Pentateuch, the first five books of Moses, and sometimes the sixth volume. Not, however, the sixth or seventh book which I just mentioned. This Torah, to the Kabbalist, therefore, was nothing more nor less than the absolute, immutable law of existence. A law which both gods and men must obey. A law from which even the creating power could never escape. For it was no more possible for the Creator to fashion a universe outside of law than it is possible for a chemist in a laboratory to make an experiment succeed if it is contrary to the laws governing that experiment. Thus the law becomes, to a sense, existence. The law is not a person, nor an intelligence as we know it, but the intrinsic, inevitable pattern in energy. It is something which we all must use. It is something that is present in every compound to integrate that compound. It is not the life in the compound, but the pattern determining the fact of the compound. This law can be, and sometimes was, considered to be equivalent to the will of God. But according to perhaps some schools, at least, the will of God was only the obedience of God, by means of which deity moved only according to that law, by means of which all motion, movement, or existence must be regulated. This law, then, was the tremendous sleeping giant. This law was in everything. But in all these substances, it was not a consciousness, but an archetype. It was not necessarily a being any more than an architect's drawing is a being. It was a vibrant, inevitable process inherent in energy. And no matter what we do or how we do it, everything accomplished must be according to the law of its kind. And to the Kabbalah, even the Ancient of Ancients could not exist beyond, outside of, or superior to the law of existence. Thus it is written in the Kabbalah, that when the ancient, whose name be blessed, was resolved to create the universe, this great one, the Ancient of Days, first called loudly into space and brought forth Torah, the law, and communed with Torah, and obeyed and followed the instruction of Torah, thus grouping the 22 letters or the shining diadem into the patterns that were decreed by Torah. We almost have the same feeling in the great opera of the Ring, Wagner's wonderful story of the Norse land, when Odin calls forth from the earth the mother of all mysteries, the Ancient One, Erda, the earth woman, nature, the great mother who can never be denied. In the opening section of the Kabbalah, therefore, when the Ancient One called forth Torah, it is written that he spoke to her. Therefore, in this context, Torah becomes the mother of mysteries. Torah becomes the mysterious, invisible, silent partner of God. And it is Torah that reveals to deity the maximum of its powers and prepares or ordains for it the processes and procedures which it shall follow. It is as though a man shall say, I shall build a house. The first natural thought is that this house must have a plan. The power to create this plan involves a knowledge of stress, a knowledge of construction and pattern, a knowledge of materials to be used. And if this knowledge is not adequate, the house will not be perfect. Therefore, the Great One calls forth the architect spirit to decree the way in which the house shall be erected. And in the Kabbalah, deity calls forth Torah as the one who has always existed, the one who can be brought out of darkness by will and energy, but also the Torah as the great mother of mysteries is the one who must be obeyed. The very concept, then, gives us a rather interesting point. Now, this point has perhaps some merit to us in our modern thinking. Science, perhaps, in its desperate search after a godless universe, has pursued the phantom of Torah and has failed to recognize that this existence remains only itself until consciousness moves upon the face of the deep and calls forth the world. Thus, the anthropomorphism of the Kabbalah is not good and evil, but God and law. We have assumed a certain despotism. Kings make laws and break them at their pleasure. We have invested celestial royalty with these attributes. But at the same time, we are inclined to believe ourselves that although the laws of men are corruptible, the laws of heaven may not be corrupted. Perhaps we will then not find it too difficult to conceive the possibility that the primordial substance or essence from which is fashioned both the body of God and the body of men has its own rules by which this fashioning must take place, and that these rules are not imposed by an outside will, but are Zen-like. They are the effortless efforts of space. They are that in which there is no need for consciousness. For consciousness is not necessary for the continual motion of the law in its own nature. Consciousness is only necessary for an exceptional motion of law, or the adaptation of law to a particular purpose. The river flows from the mountains to the sea, like the Yangtze, mother of waters. The motion of this river to the Chinese was an eternal fact and was much like law itself. But the Chinese, recognizing by degrees the power of law, began to make use of the current of the Yangtze. They put little wheels in the water to be turned by the current, and with these wheels they gained a certain power to turn other wheels and stones and grind grain. Later also they sought to irrigate their fields by turning the waters of the river. They created dams and channels. Now as soon as they began this activity, consciousness took over the use of the waters. But this consciousness was not all-knowing. And as a result of that, many of the efforts to use the waters led to tragedy for man. And this water, which also supplied him with his water of life, was the same in which he could drown. So in the great mystery of space, the Blessed One, the Ancient of Ancients, whose name be glory, as the sovereign conscious intellect, called upon the law to use the law. And the law, in its symbolic sense, made a covenant with the Ancient of Ancients and said in substance, not verbally, but in principle, obey my rules and I will make you the greatest of the kings of the world. Disobey my rules and I will destroy you utterly. Therefore, God, being of all wisdom, possessed the wisdom of obedience. God, being all good, used law only for goodness. God, being all mind, administered law with mindfulness. But actually, this mysterious power was the dynamic. It was this dynamic, then, by means of which the emanation or existence of the world became possible. Creation, then, was simply an unfolding of the will of God according to the law of existence. It was an unfolding within law. For creation itself was a monument to its own law. For it had its origin, its beginning, its infancy, its childhood, its maturity, and its fullness of years. It became populated with orders of life, and every one of these lives was under law. and there was no power within these lives to raise their hands to heaven, to ask to be released from law. Therefore, all that heaven could do was instruct man in the keeping of the law. We may not fully agree with all of this type of thinking, but we must admit it was a rather grand idea. It was tremendous in its implications. The law itself, by its own nature, created the concept of good and evil. Law was not good because it was not a being. God, by cooperation with the law, might be termed good, because good is that which wishes, desires, or impels the fulfillment of truth. But the law itself was neither good nor ill. It was simply of its own kind, its own nature, and its own eternity. While eternity rested, law was not obvious. And Böhme, the German mystic, brings this out very clearly. There is no manifestation of law until the processes of creation begin. Then these processes flow according to law and are molded by law into the everlasting likeness of itself. Now, law also, because it is not a being, because it is not of ambition or of thoughtfulness or of any particular plan or purpose for its creation, for the thing that it does, law simply operates while creation exists. And if and when creation ceases, law retires into its own unmanifested root. For without creation, there can be no manifestation of law. Therefore, if a creating power determines the end of its own creation, then the laws governing that creation simply subside again into existence. The creation cannot exist without law, but the law cannot be knowable without creation. And law in an uncreating state is simply silence, the eternal expanse of unconditioned potential. In the Kabbalah, this concept of space law was held to be feminine. And perhaps in this sense of the word, the average ardent feminist of today will not object to the usage as being detrimental. This is no disparagement. Actually, it seems to tell us that even God must obey, that this eternal mother principle is therefore supreme in space. Now, why would we assign this concept to a maternal polarization? Obviously, because the existence of existence itself sets forth the area in which a creational process can occur, and the operation of will upon